Hey there, people. Hope you're all doing well. Welcome to episode number 10, which is a conversation with portrait and documentary photographer Emil Holber, who is someone that I've known for a couple of years now, and he's a great photographer, really switched on and passionate, and we catch up fairly regularly, but it was nice to sit down and have a proper in-depth chat about his background and his work. The conversation starts with a bit about his recently released project, The Hidden City, which you can find on his website along with all his other projects. And also, I'm going to link to the Radio 4 show that we mentioned in the conversation, which was something that he produced alongside his Welcome to the Quiet Zone project and is well worth a listen. Likewise, if you want to find Emil in all the usual social media spots, you can. He's on Instagram, Twitter, etc. Find him, follow him, catch up with what he's up to. And if you feel inclined to do so, you can do the same for Neutral Exposure as well. You can find us on Instagram at neutral.exposure, and it'd be great if you wanted to follow and keep up with all the episode releases. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the conversation with Emil Holber. Welcome to Neutral Exposure, a space for reflection and inspiration with photographers across a range of disciplines. My name's Al Simmons.
City. It's a project that I started. It would have been, I think, actually in terms of the photo shoot, starting in December, and it went into January. And it's a commission by Culture Mile in London, and they're a creative organisation that have been set up by the City of London Corporation, and they've got some senior partners being Barbican, London Symphony Orchestra, LSO, Guildhall School of Music and Drama, and also the Museum of London. And it's part of a big project to effectively they want to refocus what the city's got to offer. It's not all just big financial houses, you know, and legal entities. And actually what there is a huge amount of creativity and creative output going in within that sort of square mile within the City of London. And it was an interesting process because I got a recommendation. This would have been back, I think, spring last year, 2019. And it was an email. It was actually from someone I've worked with quite a few years ago. And she said, listen, she said, I think I've got something you might be interested in. You know, and I was like, yeah, fine, let's have a look. So, you know, you meet up and sat down. And it was actually a woman called Sian who's at Culture Mile. And she was looking at someone to go in and start to document some of the activities and some of the productions they're putting on. And within that meeting, I thought, hang on a minute. Actually, I think you're missing a trick. I think you've got that opportunity to refocus the narrative and actually create your own narrative so you can really project what you want from this. So with a little bit of more conversation, I went away and I started to look through all of the different partner organizations within Culture Mile. I think at the time there was over 40 and I think they're now 60 or something. And they're hugely varied. I mean, you've got everything from Pathology Museum at Barts through to Innovation Warehouse above what is Smithfield Market. You've got real estate companies like Helical. You've got some of the big hitters like Link Letters. Obviously, the big partners like Barbican and Guildhall School of Music and Drama. And then going around it, I thought, hang on a minute. You've got the livery companies in there. There's a huge amount of heritage. There's a huge amount of creativity. I wonder if I can distill all of these different organizations into a triptych.
Yeah. Do you think that's why she thought of you? Because you're looking at a bigger story than just a series of portraits.
I think some of the work certainly, yes, it does lead. I mean, the work, your previous work is kind of your calling card in a way. And certainly the person that put me in contact was aware of some of the style and the approach I was doing. That more formal environmental portrait was a lot more built in terms of the subtext of the composition. And I kind of ran with it. And actually, it's one of those rare times you get a full artistic license. And I went back and I kind of put a proposal back, actually, and it flew. And, you know, the summer went through, other priorities in terms of their end, timing issues as well in terms of my work schedule. And we got all the stars aligned and we started the shoot in December. And that went on. We ended up photographing 18 organizations. And they're 18 very different organizations. Mm. And within the triptych, there's the personal persons that kind of embody the spirit of the organization. There's an object that sort of signifies the organization and also a space. And in that, I wanted that sort of sense of discovery. So after the initial emails and phone calls with some of the individuals at each organization, it was also site visits. You kind of have to go around. Because if you're going to reveal this, what I ended up calling the hidden city, then you've got to have a sense of discovery in there. And it was, it's quite an epic task putting all of those people together and getting all the shooting schedule in there. But yeah, it was really, really good. And we completed it in January. And it was actually put through into, we're going to do a huge, big reveal, a big printed exhibition.
Was that always the plan, or was that something that came out throughout the process?
There's a number of ways that certainly Culture Mile want to present it. And within that mix, you know, there's always a wish for, isn't there? Sort of like aim high and, you know, see what comes out.
Sure.
And exhibition was certainly one of them. And I think when I started to putting, you know, a few of these triptychs together and then giving them samples, you know, they really, really got behind it. I thought, actually, we really can make this quite something. Mm. And we did a tester, actually, at the Guildhall with the Lord Mayor of London. We did a, this is back in, God, it's all a bit of a blur at the moment, but it was back in February, I think it was actually now. And we put together some of the prints, and each of them are over 2 meters longest side, and then up on two big eagles, beautifully printed, mounted, and glass mounted and everything. And we put that through. It was like a business breakfast for like 150 key City of London individuals, and it was really well, really well received. And then we're going to put it out into a big exhibition at the Great Hall in at Barts Hospital. And for the current situation, it all kind of all stopped.
All got put on hold a little bit.
The invitations are on hold. So and now Culture Mile were very aware. They wanted to get something out, and actually, in the last couple of weeks, now we're starting to tease that out. And putting it out there and communicating some of the stories that are going on behind it. And certainly from their perspective, they want this to go right through the year. And obviously, you know, like everyone, they're kind of hoping for some sort of normality and how to navigate putting that story out. So yeah, the hidden city. Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah, cool. And now how typical is that of a project for you, you know, kind of getting that original nugget and then building it into a bigger narrative and a bigger story and, you know, kind of taking it more long form?
Now that's interesting. That's quite observant, because I think this could even be the third or fourth project. I call it a project because that's in the spirit of it. This is how I see it, but it turns into a full-on a commercial enterprise.
Yeah, well, it's not just a single commission, is it? You know, you are making a bigger project out of it.
Yeah, that's true. And I like to create a sort of mini ecosystem around that as well. I mean, I suppose in some ways there was a little bit of a test that went back. There were twofold, actually. And it was two projects. One was in Norway and the other one was in West Virginia in the USA. And one of them, I was thinking, you know, I had this kernel of an idea about, you know, are there any quiet places left around the world? Are there places where you can't actually easily communicate? You know, I have the privilege of traveling well with my work. And every time you turn that mobile on, you get a 4G signal. And actually, I was doing some work up on Baffin Island one winter, which was extremely remote.
Man, I really want to go to Baffin Island. I noticed it on a map a few months ago, and I was like, fuck, this huge great island and you know, like, I don't know, a couple of thousand people living there or whatever.
Well, it's just under 30,000 people. And the area,
okay, so more than a couple, yeah.
Yeah, if you look at, actually, it's part of Nunavut, which is in Canada.
It's huge.
And it's actually, yeah, it's massive. It's actually the size, it's land area. Nunavut's the size of Mexico or Indonesia, and it's got 30,000 people, like one high school. It's very remote. But again, you know, there I am out on the sea ice, and I couldn't believe it. I actually got signal, and I was like, wow, this is just ridiculous. Is there anywhere on this planet? So I had started looking around, and I thought, you know, this could be a personal project. And actually, the more research I did, it is nearly impossible. However, there is an area in West Virginia up in the Appalachians where there's a federally enforced area without wireless communication. And that kind of put the ideas in motion. And I had this thing of a sort of formal documentary, some portraits and landscapes and texture of the area. And so I started to do a little bit of research, but actually in the back of my mind, it was like, there's something missing. And as much as I, you know, live and breathe photography, I absolutely love it. I also am passionate about radio, particularly speech radio. Okay. And, you know, even since I was a teenager, I just loved it. That kind of really well-produced Radio 4. And I just thought, hang on a minute. And I was looking at that year, I was looking at the work schedule, and there was a gap, you know, early autumn. And I just thought, yeah, I can see this being a radio show as well, or a radio story. So I reached out to Radio 4, as you do. And bearing in mind at that point, I'd never even recorded myself. I'd never made any radio at all. And I reached out to a senior producer who I'd worked with previously on a different project, and I kept in contact. And she said, yeah, it's a really good idea, but we're between commissioning rounds, nothing's gonna happen. It's a really good idea, but you're not known at the BBC and you haven't even done radio, but it's a good idea, you know. And it was interesting because she went away, came back 2 weeks later, a couple more phone calls, a few more emails, and actually Radio 4 greenlighted the whole thing. Nice. So that turned into, you know, a commission. And actually I pushed it to the point where I wanted to go out. I wanted to do all of the recordings to satisfy the radio and also still produce good quality photographic work. And, you know, that's two very different headspaces. So actually the BBC were really, really, really accepting. And they also put the payment and expenses and everything in there to extend that trip more than it should do for radio. So I could able to do all the recordings with Sarah Jane Hall as the producer as well. She would leave, I would continue, and then I would also continue and retrace a lot of the steps and do the photographic work. And it was interesting coming back. I was really nervous. I thought, you know, have I got that quality? Have I got the tonality right? Mm-hmm. And when it went down to the edit, it was like the original proviso was actually one radio program, and actually it turned into 5-part series. It's been repeated since. You know, it got
It's great. I mean, I'll put a link to it in the description for this, because it's really worth listening to.
Yeah, I mean, it's still on BBC Sounds. I mean, it was, you know, got pick of the week. It got replayed again late last summer. Welcome to the Quiet Zone, and it was just received really well. And it was interesting because then, you know, BBC Magazine get involved because they like that sort of cross-platform content. And, you know, I can put some words down as well, so I was confident in doing that. And then that propagated it. Someone listened to the trailer alone, actually, for it, which was it was quite nice because I thought my life was complete. They had news quiz on the Friday night, and they put a trailer out for up and coming stuff. So I was included in the trailer before news quiz. But awesome. You know, and then at the time, the editor of Huck magazine was like, "This is really great." So then they framed it, and actually they made a really beautiful feature. I put the words to it, and it kind of, you know, ends up becoming, you know, as I say, this sort of like subject, an ecosystem around the original kernel of the project. And it's proved quite successful. So in a way, yes, the hidden city, my approach certainly was to create that similar sort of ecosystem. And even in actually in response to our current situation, there was within some of the outreach sort of learning teams within Culture Mile and the City of London Corporation, they were thinking of ways to sort of, you know, give more depth to the hidden city. And one of them is actually they do works within academy chains in London. Okay. And it's been great. So all of a sudden I've been putting together webinars, educational modules in terms of A-levels and BTEC around and using the hidden city as a framework to do that teaching. So again, it's not something I even envisaged at the beginning.
Sure,
of that,
sure, sure.
Of
it kind of grows organically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. So do you, how do you describe yourself as a photographer? You know, are you simply, I wouldn't say you're a portrait photographer, you know, would you say you're a documentarian, you're a, you know, an assignment photographer, you know, would you even pigeonhole yourself in that way?
Oh, that's tricky, isn't it? I mean, it's part putting that, you know, when you put that about section on your website, it's probably the most difficult thing to do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because when you talk about blending radio and interviews and, you know, written work alongside the photography, you know, it's almost journalistic as much as it is, you know, portrait photography or landscape photography or what have you.
That's true. I think it's in that respect, there's definitely an element of, yes, that journalistic approach, that sort of nearly investigative element, that's definitely part of it. I mean, if I'm not behind the camera, I'm really, really interested in politics, geopolitics, the environment, and just the general sort of society's discourse, and that's been a running theme since I was, you know, an early teenager. And I think that, yes, photography is one of those. I like to use that as a springboard to have a look further. And I think it's very interesting because actually there's some landscape photographers that are just fantastic. There's some portrait photographers that are just extraordinary. But in that respect, yeah, I suppose I feel comfortable and it feels nearly natural. You know, if you're taking an environmental portrait, a lot of the time, yes, it's valid, I don't know, someone in their workplace, but actually I like to dig in further. I want to see if there's any extra element that I can put into that setup. So it's like distilling down the subject really as much as I can. Mm. And actually by placing often someone just within the landscape of their environment, it's true. And that does, it starts to sort of just blur that boundary. Is it strictly a portrait? Is it a landscape? Is it social documentary? You know, and I think the social documentary part in recent years is certainly the smartphone in our pocket. And in that respect, I mean, it's nearly unbeaten. I mean, it's really, 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 really strong form of, I mean, I consider it art used appropriately. And you kind of step back. And I think that sometimes there still needs to be that formality. I'm not going back to sort of Auguste Sander or someone like that, but I think we need some time just to slow down and just observe a little bit more. And not just reacting to a fad or the treatment you can put in post, for example.
Right.
I like a degree of honesty to the photography I'm doing as well. You know, I do see a difference between a photograph and an image, and they're both valid, but don't pass the image off as a photograph, you know, especially when it's been heavily, heavily manipulated. So the work, my kind of workflow and my approach is to take all of these different elements and can I faithfully, you know, present that subject and the meaning behind that subject. And I do tend to put that work ethos into both commercial work and the project work. And it's, I have to say, I love getting that balance where actually the commercial work allows me to do that too. You know, that is really, it's kind of like the sweet spot. And if I could succeed that on every commercial project, that would be heaven.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. How important is it for you to have time to, I suppose, prepare or research for that? You know, how much of it is, you know, reacting to what you find when you get to a certain location or organization, and how much of it is, you know, how much have you prepared in your mind already in terms of what story you're going to tell?
That's twofold. If it's within a commercial client, you know, interpreting a brief, there's a lot of research. And if there's a creative agency or a design agency involved, there's a clear strategy with marketing, communications have their angle, then yeah, absolutely. It's your responsibility as a professional to start to, you know, frame that and get it all together and to ensure you're managing that expectations of the client's brief. That's absolute. And I will do exhaustive research on that. And in fact, if you go back to the Hidden City, that was a few days worth. I mean, I went into every organization, you know, where's the little nuggets that I can put together? And in doing that process, you just by default have a much more thorough understanding of that organization you're going to enter. And yeah, it does help as well, for sure. On the personal stuff, that's a little bit different. I like a sense of discovery and I like that surprise. I like the serendipity that goes ahead with that as well. So, you know, there's a lot of digital tools. I mean, I don't know, was it Street View or something like that? I know that a lot of, I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I know a lot of photographers go into a huge amount of detail on where they're going to and what they're going to investigate. I kind of don't. I just, if it's international, I want to make sure that I'm not stranded at the airport. I can get to nearest city where maybe, you know, my first, you know, couple of nights is in terms of accommodation. But aside from that, of course, I'm generalizing a little bit. I do want to keep it a little bit loose and I want to be able to invest the time in just going with it. Because
sure,
actually,
sure,
so many times that's the winner, you know. And I think over researching it from that perspective, from personal perspective, you can nearly blink your eyes because it's like you're staying to this sort of false built-in schedule where you don't actually have to, especially in terms of investigating an area like Welcome to the Quiet Zone. Mm. You know, I mean, there was all sorts of incidents. I mean, I give a perfect example. There was a guy called Bob, and in this particular
there's always a guy called Bob.
Yeah, this guy called Bob. and Bobby and Bob. And it was interesting because I heard about this guy. He owns a number of convenience stores across the valley where, in fact, I won't take too much. If you want to listen to Welcome to the Quiet Zone, you'll find out. But at the heart of this valley is a very, very, very sensitive telescope. And through that valley, there's three convenience stores, stroke petrol stations, gas stations in America. And going through it, I'd heard that everyone's saying, you've got to speak to him. He's the guy you need to, he just knows everyone around here. And again, you know, I've been there at this point probably about a week, and I turned up one evening to one of these convenience stores, and it's completely closed. All the lights are out. It was completely just really beautiful moonlight, and there was some really old chromium petrol pumps. I thought, that would be kind of cool, so I got the tripod out, put the camera up, and I was just doing some long exposures, and then this, you know, all of a sudden out of nowhere, this pickup turns up, and it is proper massive pickup. The window goes down, this smoke comes out where I couldn't even see the individual. And between him and I, very deliberately placed, very visible, was an automatic rifle.
Right.
And, you know, basically it was, you know, in no polite terms, what the fuck are you doing on my property? So obviously, wow. I go into the, you know, I have a British passport, ha ha. You know? I know the Queen, kind of, yeah. You know. Do you want a cup of tea kind of vibe? And he's looking at me like not buying any of this. And I just said, listen, I said, you know, your petrol pumps are amazing. And he's thinking, this guy is absolutely nuts. And obviously that sort of threat level dropped down. He basically gave up, kind of said goodnight and drove off. And that was it. So Bobby's gone. So anyway, nearly a week later, I find out he's at one of his big convenience stores, which is right next to a big sawmill. And it was a really, really vibrant kind of junction in a really disused, I can't even call it a town. It was like a settlement on a junction. Mm. And the convenience store and the life going on in there. And actually, it was a lot of Puerto Rican labor at this sawmill. And they're all coming in, getting subs and sodas and stuff like that. And the car park was just chaos. You felt like something was just going to kick off all the time. And yeah, Bobby's in there. And I went in and I was like, listen, you know, I'm doing this this story. And he said, yeah, I know exactly who you are. I know what you're doing. And he was basically, he was starting to say, yeah, you were there that day, this day, right across this huge area of West Virginia. Anyway, he did end up kindly giving about 15 minutes of his time. And I managed to get a photograph of him as well. And, you know, I mean, I had literally 3 minutes for a photo with him, but I had exactly what I wanted in mind. And I even pushed it as well in terms of his body language. I provoked him with regards to a cigarette. But, you know, again, if you do too much pre-planning, those opportunities just don't arise. And that sort of, it ended up being serendipity. So it went from, you know, a situation of threat through to something that actually really kind of added some color to the story. And certainly his, I mean, he was kind of like built like a whippet, but I mean, you wouldn't mess with him. I mean,
yeah, sure.
Nothing Bobby can get hold of you in the Appalachian.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like, he knew your every movement.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He really did as well. Yeah. So, but you know, but that, I like that sense of discovery and that sense of meeting people as well. I mean, I mean, you'll see it if you go to my work. There's just people everywhere on it. It's a real passion, absolutely. Mm. Yeah.
So that sense of adventure has always been there in the stuff that you've worked on.
Yeah, I would say so. You know, even back to as soon as I have, you know, my own money that I'm earning as, you know, whatever it is, late teenager, I'm off, you know, and that was it. Before I could drive, I'd still be getting on a bus up to Glasgow and up into West, you know, Northwest Scotland, you know.
Okay.
And then go and lose yourself for, you know, 10 days in the Knoydart Peninsula. Yeah, for sure. That sense of adventure has always been there. And then you can get a car and you realise, well, I like skiing, so you go to the Alps, so you just get in the car and go, you know, that sort of stuff. And then obviously you work out you also need to earn money to supply all of that as well. But
sure.
Yeah, for sure, that sense of adventure has always been there. Yeah.
There seems to be quite a draw to the States as well. There's quite a few projects that you've worked on that have taken you to the States.
It's a beguiling place, that's for sure. I think I probably speak for a lot of people, but it's like a love-hate with the place as well. you know, it's got so much to offer. I mean, it's fantastic. And then it kind of lets itself down as well, you know. But I suppose that could be, yeah, every country could be accused of that. But no, I absolutely love it over there. And it's a place that I first went to in the early 90s. And even that, actually, my first, I set foot on US soil, certainly from a, you know, visitor standpoint. It wasn't the usual going to Boston or New York or LA or Vegas. It was actually San Antonio, Texas.
Okay.
You know,
what took you there?
At the time, 21, girlfriend at the time, and we thought, let's do a bit of a road trip. So we did, you know, it was, yeah, that was quite something, actually. And that whole sort of border area, and we ended up doing, I don't know how many miles in 6 weeks, you know, took in some good chunks of the Southwest. And yeah, certainly through the rest of the 90s into noughties, there was a few of us that used to go skiing there and do different places. And then even within that capacity, you know, back then it was a film camera, but you know, I'd still be taking that camera. Mm. You know, I have another, you know, I have non-photographic job, but you know, I'm still out there and still using up all of my time, and certainly all of my holiday allocation as an employee was going out doing projects. You know, I'd find myself in Nevada just checking out, you know, old mining communities, and you know, and again, loads of serendipity coming out of that, and finding out about Rachel in Nevada kind of before it became a thing, or the internet allowed it to become a thing, you know, with Area 51. But you know, it was interesting, and I just thought, you know, this is such a diverse landscape and diverse people as well. And you know, I've been really privileged. I've covered a huge amount of the states now, and really quite in depth. And in fact, actually, one of my latest projects that I'm working on, it's to see the light of day yet, but it's actually based still, going back to those original roots on the border area between Arizona and Mexico. And certainly it feels like it's like a journey where you're observing things without even realizing on your first trips. In that particular case, it was a road trip, you know, it was a holiday with a girlfriend, you know, but actually that inquiring mind, you can feel it. It's quite beguiling down there, and you're thinking, ah, you know, and actually now I'm in a position in my life where I'm able to go back there, you know, with skills and photographic skills that I've acquired, and
sure,
and having much more of that, like you say, that journalistic approach, and starting to actually put together quite an expansive story about the criminality that's falling out from the fact of the tensions around that border with Mexico and the USA.
Okay. Yeah. So what is that project?
Alphabet
in its
Soup.
in its broader sense.
In its broader sense, Alphabet Soup, which is a working title, which has stuck with me actually. It's the premise is simple. For many years I kind of have kept an eye on that border area, and it doesn't matter about let's just not get put slightly aside by Trump and his rhetoric, because actually it doesn't matter whether it's a Democrat in the White House or Republican, you know, over many, many decades, actually that border region, and if you take the four states that do it, the border, the US and Mexico, you know, it's a very contentious issue. And actually there's a huge amount of documentaries and videos and photo stories, and I mean, really astonishingly strong work as well, really formal photo essays, hard documentaries, and that's sort of centering on the drug cartels. And in certainly with Hollywood, you know, they nearly, dare I say, sex it up.
Yeah. You know,
that sort of narcos approach.
Mm.
You quite rightly, huge amount of focus on the humanitarian side. And obviously that is, you know, it's a pressing issue. But actually the voice that I rarely hear is actually law enforcement. And for a few years, it kind of was just battling around my head. I thought, actually, you know, ultimately, law enforcement, they have to just, you know, they've got to police the policies that are set to them. So, you know, as Trump was coming through and he's like, we're going to build that wall, and then he actually got into Capitol Hill, that rhetoric slowed down a bit, but certainly the impetus was still there. And there you have, you know, another administration going, right, we're going to put this huge construction into process. And I started to do a little bit of investigation. And on that note, it's very interesting because actually Clinton, up until Trump, had actually built most of the current wall, I say in inverted commas, that you see. Certainly if there's a news broadcast and there's a port of entry, sorry, you know, that infrastructure, that's a legacy of Clinton. To a degree, Bush Jr. too, and then other things fiscally stopped that happening. But obviously, you know, Trump has pushed that back through, you know, through to the top of the agenda.
Okay.
So again, in that research, I looked around and actually there was a particular sheriff in Pima County, Sheriff Mark Napier, and I was listening to him and he was just so eloquent in the way he was framing the issues there. And I thought, oh, maybe he's the person I need to speak to. So again, you know, I thought, I think I have a bit of a project here. And I tested it. I put together some notes. I did a little bit more research just to get kind of the language right and to make sure I was familiar with the different factions going on that border. And actually, the more I learned, Pima County is one of the largest US counties. It's massive. It's got the longest county border with Mexico, 125 miles. And it goes through some of the most hostile terrain the Sonoran Desert has to offer. I mean, the topography is quite, I mean, it's a barrier in itself. It's very remote, particularly in the summer. It's very demanding in terms of its heat and lack of access to water. So I just thought, right, well, what's it like to police that and the criminality that falls out of that border area,
right.
Notably, you know, labor in terms of trafficking, sex trafficking, and obviously narcotics. So I just went onto the internet, Pima County Sheriff's Department. I thought it's got to be the sheriff. You know, if you're from a constitutionalist perspective in the US, sheriff is the law, nothing
right,
else.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, it just feels right. Pima County was one of the last counties to actually, in the Gadsby plan, to ensure that all of the contiguous US is put together in, I think it was in 1841 now. And in doing so, I phoned a switchboard, got through to his PA. I left a message on the voicemail thinking I'll never hear anything back. 10 minutes later, I get this email. And She said, listen, I just want to make sure that it is you that left this message. And the sheriff will be back in contact with you within 24 hours.
Wow, nice.
Stone me. Literally, I woke up and there was an email from Sheriff Napier. And the email was instructive. He said, yeah, please come. I've already instructed Sergeant Gilbert de Mendez. Please come. And
wow.
That was it. And that started the ball rolling.
Yeah. Okay, I mean, going back to the Quiet Zone project, and you know, coming across this guy who, you know, holds up a rifle to you when you kind of you know get into his territory. You know, is there any how do you play that? You know, kind of coming in as an outsider. You know, how do you find your I suppose where you're comfortable in starting to get under the surface of a community or a you know, a place that you're coming into as an Englishman.
You know, the world over, most of the time are just nice and they want to help and they're like us. You know, they're making a living, they're trying to survive, whether it's on a, you know, in a poverty level or in a successful level. Most people are pretty decent. I found that, and actually, I think within reason, killing with kindness helps. I think, yeah, for sure, when you're traveling to areas, yeah, for example, the Appalachian, you know, there's one. I remember there was a project that I started to do up in northeastern Idaho. Yeah, kind of didn't go anywhere and I kind of parked it, shelved it. But it was interesting. That part of northeastern Idaho at the time was a huge hotbed for meth labs. And I went off the beaten path because I wanted to go up to a communications tower that I could see up out from the valley base. I could see this tower. I just thought, yeah, you know, you go up there. And actually sometimes, I say naivety, but sometimes that near, just see what happens approach can come slightly unstuck, because what I hadn't realized is, in fact, that area, you're going through some hardcore meth lab territory.
Okay.
And actually you realize that you need to be vouched for before you're going into these territories. So actually it's a learning process. You put down and actually, you know, the next town down the valley we're describing, I was like, well, you know, if you want to do that again, you need to speak to so-and-so. So again, it's about your intentions. I think making your intention clear. I think transparency as well. You know, don't bullshit your way out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to come back and bite you. But I think most people are pretty decent. You know,
yeah.
They don't have an ulterior motive. And I think if they see as a threat, you know, especially, I mean, okay, you know, it's not like I'm physically huge or have a threatening manner, I don't think. They probably look at my hair and think I'm some sort of pacifist, you know. So, yeah. you know, and I think there's some common sense as well, you know, but then that, you know, that has to be wherever you are in the world. You know, you can be in a dodgy situation in London if you really want it to be. You know?
Sure, sure. But as you say, if the intention is good and honest, then you don't meet any sort of opposition to it. So the Alphabet Soup project, what form has that taken? You know, is that purely photography? Is it portrait photography, landscape? You know, is there any kind of other elements involved in that? You know, as you say, you've put together radio shows in the past and things like that. You know, is that just taking the form of photography, or is there more to it?
It is. Initially, it was going to be strictly just photography. And I think still I'm in a shaping it kind of editing process at the moment. But when I first arrived there, I was actually back in 2018, I was doing some work in West Texas. And after that initial email with the Sheriff Napier, I just thought, I am going to take that invite. I need to go to Pima County. I just need to get a feel for it. You know, I can just bolt on a few extra days. So I did. I think it was 6, maybe 7 days. And I just thought, if I can meet him, maybe get a sense of the different parts of Pima County and what they got to police. So it's like a smorgasbord, you know, just being on the ground, not seeing it via a report on the internet, but actually just being on the ground. And I just thought, I'll try it out. So I got there. I was made very welcome. I was shown quite a bit of stuff, actually, in a very short period of time. At no point was I asked formally, verbally, via email, written, or even by inference what I couldn't photograph. So that was amazing. But again, I was transparent in that. I wanted that first person, non-US citizen approach to just observing it, because actually it was put to me by one of the captains, you know, I was having quite a meaningful conversation. I was like, what's happening here is not normal. And he said, Emil, it's the new normal. From their perspective, it's completely normal. You know, and that was very sobering. And actually coming away, and one of the reasons I've called it Alphabet Soup, is I started to tally up the different state and federal agencies that are working just this particular part of Pima County in terms of securing that border, or certainly infiltrating and disrupting the criminality that comes around that border. And it was 16 different state and federal agencies. Right. You know, it's a huge blend of law enforcement with different jurisdictions, different funding avenues, different skill sets. And I thought, wow. So I did come away and I just thought, a challenge to myself. I love a human.
Okay.
Can I remove the portrait, you know, just to keep myself creative? Can I get that sense of place through landscape? Because another takeaway on that first visit was just how beautiful the landscape was. In fact, I've yet to come to investigate an area with more beautiful, untouched desert scape. I mean, really, it's like virgin desert. And again, it's free of all the usual sort of US visual tropes. There's no telegraph roads, oil pumps. There's no advertising hoardings. There's no gas stations. There's no ranch roads. There's nothing. It really is untouched. And in that respect, you've then got the architecture and the infrastructure around surveillance from the US side. And then you have actually often equal amounts, because certainly funding wise, from in terms of the cartels of shipping, getting all the contraband across, and also the resourcefulness in terms of getting all those payments back. So I was thinking, can I get something that is formal, just trying to get that juxtaposition between an area that you just want to go investigate as a botanist, or, you know, I mean, it's just beautiful, but you wouldn't want to go for a hike there by yourself.
Okay.
You know, that's a different proposition. And we're talking huge areas of land. So can I get that into a sort of landscape form, and can I do it in a different approach? Can I blend different ways of recording that? So I did everything. I took, you know, 6-7 cameras, medium format digi, 35mm digi, iPhone. I even bought a burner phone, you know, flip burner phone, brand new, with a 2-megapixel camera. So, you know, and again, I started shooting a lot of it with that whole blend. So, and that call me naive, but that's quite tricky.
Yeah, it sounds like all those together.
So, yeah. But so far it was, it's. I think the difficulty for me is in terms of how you present that, because actually the narrative can be spun in so many different ways. I want it to be faithful to what I saw and what I've experienced. When I first went for that sort of preamble investigation trip, I said to them, I'll be back, but I need to have more time, you know, and they kind of looked, yeah, we won't see you again, you know, and I did. I waited. My proviso was I wanted it to be particularly hot, so I had to wait for summer. Mm-hmm. And I figured out that I needed at least 4 weeks on the ground there to start to have the opportunity to document certain things that happen within that, you know, crime kind of doesn't run 9 to 5. And I think,
did that heat have something to do with it as well? You know, you say you wanted it to be quite hot. Was that the kind of atmosphere that you wanted?
Yeah, I wanted it to be kind of like scorched.
Yeah.
And it's hot. I mean, it's really hot. There will be days where it'd be hitting, you know, 48, 49 and 50 Celsius.
Fact,
and it'd go all day, you know, and if in Fahrenheit, it'll be 2 a.m. and it's 101, you know, just relentless. Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, it's just in terms of having that availability of water, so you end up with a ton of it in the vehicle, and you start to be very sensitive to how difficult it is to not only try to get stuff through that border, whether it's human trafficking, drug trafficking, etc., but also the limitations that are put on law enforcement to even do that. And that was something that I thought was key to the tone and the feel of the story, for sure. And I think visually it brings something to it as well. You know, the desert, that sort of, you know, going out, that soft light that you get, I don't know, Palm Springs or something, you know, there's the golden hour, and there's just like endless lifestyle and fashion shoots done at that point, of course, because it's just beautiful. You know, the color and the tones and the softness of the shadows are absolutely epic. I'm also mindful, you know, I'm out there. The reality is the work that I'm documenting and investigating, that does not stop. It doesn't matter whether it's burning hot sun or not. The weather systems are relatively stable there during that time of year as well. The sun's just out with very little cloud days. You know, I mean, literally, there'll be half a dozen over a month. The rest of it's just sun out. That's it. So I took a decision to continue to shoot in that as well. So it kind of, from a landscape perspective, yes, you could say that that's blurring it because it's not waiting for the optimum conditions. But my documentary head dictated that. So then you're looking at compositional elements, subject focus within the landscape. And again, that was the approach I took. So it doesn't matter whether, you know, what the recording medium was. I wasn't shying away. That's what I would shoot. And I'd try and do it faithfully. I mean, sometimes I might, you know, I don't know, just on a put a neutral grad filter on just to control it a little bit. But actually, no, you know, and I didn't kind of want it too rough and ready. I also was mindful of there is a huge amount of documentation about the really grimy, grubby side of it. And that it's not that it's easy to do, but you can see that, you know, and it was having the opportunity to when you go along on ride alongs and you're there within, you know, you're within a huge seizure, be it a vehicle seizure. You're there with an intelligence led car stop. So that's a mule for the cartel. And that might be 2 months, you know, that could be intelligence led from Mexico, a blend of agencies. I went on one with the DEA, you know, and you're actually in the stop vehicle, you know, and that's a whole surreal day. You know, that's like a 14-hour operation to that point, you know, and the other person in that vehicle, and that is it. That's the stop vehicle. And it's not your regular stop, inverted commas. It's not like your faulty brake light, because obviously you're in a situation where you're in with Border Interdiction Unit who have all that intelligence. So it's actually really, and there's, you know, a whole net of agency support that goes around that stop. Okay. But having that opportunity to witness it and the mundanity of it, I mean, it was just, you know, you think, you know, in the films, it's all going to be sexy and there's going to be guns flying around. Yeah, sure. There's weapons all the time and there's narcotics all the time. But it's just, yeah, this particular part of Tucson's, it's okay. And it was a car wash and the guy was restoring the car wash and painting the car wash. He didn't stop through this entire time, you know, and it's 120 degrees. and there's a water filling station, and it's just people carrying on. Because again, from their perspective, this has got to be put out as though it's a normal traffic stop or a traffic violation, where in fact it's actually not. It's a huge amount of manpower and resource to ensure that that vehicle stopped. A, there's a seizure, and then the decision on when to disrupt that particular supply chain. You know, do you incarcerate the guy that's doing the, as being the mule or not? You know, and again, it was really interesting. We were in these operations, you'd be doing a lot of waiting. I mean, absolutely, they called it DOPA time, and that's it. So from Mexico, there'd be a shipment coming up. They all know it's going to happen, for example, on a Tuesday. I go meet my guys, they'll pick me up. We'll be sitting down, McDonald's, go get an Egg McMuffin, you know, and then you go, and they'd have certain places. So, you know, obviously in terms of all listening in and all the radio chat, it was like a sort of pensa movement. And I remember we used to use, actually, fun enough, another car wash analogy. We'd sit in a car wash. Just sit in a car wash for an hour, you know, or you'd be sitting in just behind of a service area to a retail park, just sitting there. So again, I started to take the views that I was having of the DOPA time, where you're just sitting there doing that mundane stuff. And actually, there was this threat that came with that, you know, which is, and there's people going on with their normal lives. You know, you're on I-10 in that stop vehicle, and there's just the normal freeway traffic. And you're aware that actually they're not aware that two lanes in is border patrol, because it's a blended operation. They just see it as a border patrol SUV. They just see it as Pima County SUV. They don't realize it's actually the vehicle that's, you know, a few hundred yards in front is actually going to be. So in that
mad world to be part of.
Yeah, very much so. But again, it's tricky. And I feel I have a huge sense of responsibility to report that. And I wanted to make sure that it was as honest as I could. And I suppose, how do you present that? You know, in terms of just image order, how do you place that? You know, it's a tricky one. There was another seemingly mundane scene, actually. There's a little airstrip near a very small town called Ajo that's down near the border. And this airstrip, it's just piece of concrete, it's got one windsock, and it's got some tarmac, which would take quite a few aircraft, and it's got two aircraft hangars, but it's not manned in any way. It has no infrastructure, there's no fueling. They've got a solar panel to do the airport or the airstrip runway lights. And actually, if you're going to look at it from, you know, you're making a film with drug smuggling involved, it's where the exchange is done. Tom Cruise in American Made would fly into this airfield. It's hilarious. It's cliched, but that's what it looks like. But it's a fully functional airstrip. And actually, I started to get another running theme when I was out there, especially on the second visit, of the amount of cartel activity in terms of execution punishments that go on US territory, on US soil. Not the other side. You hear about that all the time. There's been a gun battle, this death count just over the border. But actually the amount that goes on kind of like underneath the authority's nose.
Okay.
And I was out one day going around and coming into that airstrip, and I was with a particular sergeant. And we were just sort of typical banter, just talking about stuff. And there was this light aircraft sitting there. Anyway, she turned around. She says, "Oh, my God." She says, I can't believe I haven't told you about this. Anyway, 18 months prior, it was around Halloween. She'd finished her shift. It's 2 a.m. And she said, "Listen," she said, "I'd taken all my stuff off. I was going to bed. And dispatch called me. And they said, right, deputy's been out. He's been to the only highway in the area that's at the end of this airstrip. And he said, he's found a guy that's walking around missing an arm. And there's blood pouring everywhere." And because it was Halloween, you know, she's like, "If anyone's pulling my leg here, there's going to be trouble."
This is a long drive.
Exactly, you know. So she gets out. It's like out to the airstrip. By this point, this guy's on the floor. He's passed out. They've got air support coming in from Phoenix via the trauma unit. We're sending a helicopter out. But again, it's so remote. Even that whole process takes an hour and a half, you know, just to get it up and get over there. And they're keeping this guy alive. And the sergeant was saying, she said it was just a mess. There was just blood and bits everywhere, all over. And I was like, and this happened right here. She says exactly where that plane is. I was like, bloody hell. Anyway, turns out this guy, he was an informant actually for the US, and was undercover in in one of the cartels. And he had done so for many years. Anyway, he'd obviously been found out. He thought he was being flown into this airstrip for a bit of a birthday weekend, okay. You know, a bit of partying. So he got off. There's a few of them. He thinks this is just brilliant. Going to have a good time in America for the weekend. Mm. It took him. Obviously, at this point, he realizes what's happened. They've started the propeller blade up, and then they have fed his arm from his fingertips up to his shoulder into the propeller. Obviously, it made a complete mess. That's his punishment. They then shot him and left him for dead. So we pick up. There's a sergeant going, well, this is ridiculous. No one could believe that this story was true. There's a mess. He's missing an arm, but he's also been shot, you know. Anyway, he ended up surviving. And in fact, if he hadn't have survived, the trauma team, the surgeons, the cause of death, they said we would have had to say it was a speedboat accident because it was signs of a propeller mechanics on it. So he was telling the truth.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I kind of thought this isn't, you know, he's actually now in witness protection, but I went straight back. So I'm like, okay, what time of day was it? Can I reenact this? There's an aircraft. It's extremely similar to the one that was used. So I took a photograph of that aircraft on it. And I think that's the thing on how to approach it, going back in a very long-winded way. How do you present this? Because I think if you tell that story with the picture, then that has more weight than just that picture. And having a chance of, you know, a straight raw documentation would have had that body.
And
in this particular case, I think that actually there's more searching questions that can go around the state that they're in, that situation happened in the first place. And I think that can be powerful. And I think you can mix words with the pictures in a more long form way. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And with the, I suppose the agents who are part of these operations, you know, were they happy or able to share their kind of testimony as well? Or was it, you know, I suppose how much were they happy to be, you know, sharing their perspective?
I would take a lot of notes, a huge amount of notes, and I would ask questions, of course, and I'd ask uncomfortable questions. I mean, just before you go into the area, law enforcement worldwide, not just the US, is naturally conservative, you know, be it from a small to a large C. You're going into Arizona, traditionally, demographics are changing, but traditionally, that is a very Republican state. And you're going into an extremely contentious issue where their current president just uses it as the biggest political football going.
Right.
So you're aware of that. I don't share their politics, but at the same time, I'm sorry, I can still have a civil conversation. Because, you know, I think this was another issue. And this is, in some ways, it's my own struggle in how to present this work and how to really shape it, is that it's so polarized as a subject down there. It's so loaded. Actually, the reality being on the ground and just living and breathing it as much as I could for a month is that it's actually completely gray. It's not black and white. And you learn that, yeah, there's all the right-wing rhetoric, but there's also the left agenda. That creates problems in there as well. And actually, when I came to the different law enforcement agencies, and I would mix within them as well, predominantly Pima County Sheriff's Department and the different things that they offer, because they have a lot of different skill sets. But it was interesting in departments. What I actually experienced was really quite nuanced, what I considered to be really quite fair and reasonable law enforcement, actually. And the more conversations I had, that kind of gun-toting sheriff spitting, just did not exist. It really didn't. And I certainly didn't do it. And sure, you can have an organization could be on message maybe for 24 hours or something, but not in multiple locations with multiple teams on different shifts, you know. So in that respect, I found it really quite transparent. I felt that there wasn't a particular thing to hide. Yes, you hear of instances that are not good, but any large organization has those instances. They're going to have the bad apples, you know, and as long as there's good, relatively good governance, in theory, that should make sure that that doesn't, you know, spread within that organization. But I really did. I mean, I kind of want to say, oh God, it was all the cliches. It wasn't. And I think that was the biggest surprise of all, was just that it was really, you know, really some quite nuanced policing under what is additional pressures to a normal law enforcement, you know, role.
Okay.
And I think that that was, that was quite something. I mean, of course, there were some opinions out there, but, you know, really in the overall shape of things, this wasn't what you would actually see reported in the news. Mm. And I felt that that was another part of the story as well, that the more and more I was there, they were just like, you're just here. You're just documenting what we're doing, because they do get media requests, and they'll have networks that will come in and they'll spend half a day or half an hour. And again, actually, if you look at any report that comes around that border issue, it doesn't matter, it's in California, New Mexico, Texas, doesn't matter. Mm. It's always within a couple of miles of that port of entry. And it gives a false illusion of the reality there, because actually, if you go a few further miles down that border, there is no big fence. There's no wall, metaphorically. There's vehicle barrier at best, but, you know, you can get a shopping trolley through. You get a double buggy just straight through, you know. So, and these areas become very, very remote. So, again, it becomes that sort of cat and mouse in terms of moving everything through. But no, I found them to be, you know, certainly from Pima County Sheriff's Department and the associated agencies that are working that patch, I found them they cooperated. I was privy to a few things I think was really quite special. I was in with some intelligence meetings, which were quite exceptional. But there was no, you know, they weren't dictating what I could and couldn't do. There are a couple of situations where there's some evidence that has to be cleared, because obviously that's in terms of a normal legal system, you know, but a lot of the time they'll be like, you can't do anything with it for 6 weeks, right. You know, after that, here's my email, no problem at all, you know, but again, that was very infrequent. And when you're looking at it and you're going into document, there was one particular raid that they did on a large heroin dealer, actually, that came out of this compound in Tucson. And it was extraordinary going in there, because there was on scene a crime, whatever it was, 40 odd people, and the assailants and everything are all still there, and starting to go through, and the opportunity of that crime scene to go through that property and start documenting and piecing together some of the things that I wanted to tease out of it, all of the different family motifs and messages that go through it, bizarre things. I didn't realize this, but on every single one of those raids, there's always going to be a huge amount of porn. And right, it was always, apparently, even now, it's still DVDs, you know.
Right.
I thought it was hilarious, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So there'll be the usual pile of porn. And then you realize, actually, that as I was going through, you're going into the bathroom, you're going into the kitchen, you start to see collections of things. And one thing that really struck me was there was a number of different collections, one being sunglasses, another one being toothbrushes, hairbrushes. Okay. And again, you start investigating. It's like, this, you know, what's going on? It's like an OCD, and it's perfectly placed within all this. And they said, no, that's prison time has done
right,
that.
Right.
So they'll say to them, it's normal. To me, I'm like, why would you have all these toothbrushes grouped in
a
way? You know.
So how do you know the project's complete? You know, if you keep coming across these different layers and these different elements to it, you know, it sounds like you could just keep going back and working on this, you know, indefinitely.
Yeah.
But, you know, how do you control yourself as a photographer to say, you know, that's the story that I'm going to present?
That's an interesting question, because on this particular one, this is, and it could be, I don't know, this one, it doesn't feel finished. I mean, I know that I know photographers that get into stories that take 10 years and there's repeated visits. And obviously there's really good examples of that. And maybe I've hit that one where it does need that repetition. At the same time, I certainly have enough for a story. That's not a problem.
Sure.
And maybe it's also on reflection, maybe it's just where I am in my own creative development. Maybe I'm just like, no, this can be another level, or I can shape it in a different way. And, you know, and it's also, I mean, editing your own work's never easy, you know, but at the moment it doesn't have a natural conclusion, no. Maybe because it's just ongoing. That's thing that's there. That's
is there any temptation to cross the border and take it out of the States and onto the Mexican side?
Then where do you stop?
You know,
I put in a couple of, I actually put a couple of boundaries in. One, Pima County. You know, this is just, you know, I mean, I think the only thing that my gut feeling that I would look to extend it in terms of a series would be that there was one thing, and it's nearly a painful, well, it is a painful truth, but kind of no one talks about it at all. and that is the consumption in America. Let's not talk about labor and sex here in terms of trafficking. Mm-hmm. Let's just look at narcotics.
Yeah.
You know, it's enormous. The consumption is huge. So, you know, Nixon does his, you know, proclaims his war on drugs, whatever it was, 40 plus years ago.
Yeah.
You know, that obviously has not worked. Trillions of dollars worth of investment has not worked. And in terms of the quantities that I was privy to, in terms of actual, you know, evidence, information about these seizures that is being disrupted, it'll make your hair fall out. So my only logical thing is, at the end of the day, these cartels are only dealing as, you know, supply and demand. So if the demand's there, it's still going to happen. So, you know, that's my only extension to it that I can see as a logical extension. But I've got to have some sort of temporary conclusion to Alphabet Soup. Mm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I feel more comfortable within the space. I think with a lot of work, I probably speak for a lot of photographers, you actually need to just, you've got it, you've backed it all up, you've put it into the, you know, the different, you know, if it's negatives, you wrap them up as well and see them away, and you just, you kind of have to leave it alone.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of then have to revisit it. And actually, I think time does help that process of shaping the narrative for sure.
Yeah.
And obviously, you don't have, you know, if it's a commercial project, you've got a deadline. That's a separate issue. And yeah, for sure, that sometimes does force a decision to complete something. And sometimes that might be a pragmatic view, sometimes because it is the right thing and it's absolutely defined. On this particular one, I think it has such a breadth that I haven't found that natural conclusion yet.
Yeah. Okay. And are you someone who, do you have to be kind of dedicated to one project at a time? You know, I suppose ignoring the commercial stuff for the time being, because, you know, I suppose that's always going on in the background. But in terms of these bigger personal projects, you know, do you have to be, you know, solely absorbed in that theme and that idea at one time?
Practically, in terms of the capturing of it, i.e. getting out there with a camera, yeah, that does tend to be, that's one project at a time.
Mm.
However, I'm constantly making notes of ideas that I might have, something that's inspired me. It could be just putting like a framework together or putting little tests together. A good example, I worked on one that sprouted out of, I was actually, funnily enough, on a commercial assignment, and I kept going through one of the main areas that's fracking in the in the Surrey Hills. So I started to do a little bit of, each time I was going down doing this work, I was coming back through and I'd spend a little bit of time starting to know some of the communities that are around the anti-fracking.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was another idea. It kind of harked back to one of my early, I suppose, private investigations that I did within, it was actually within the Newbury bypass back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. I kind of wanted to see it for myself, and it felt that the fracking agenda's changed a little bit, and I felt that actually in terms of its impetus and in terms of what was happening on the ground now has just slowed down. So you then take a decision, do I invest more time into this, or do you take a pragmatic view? It's like, okay, done a little bit of research, I've got a feel, let's put it on hold, you know. And it kind of is, it's held in mind, and that's it. So, but you know, something might happen where that rejuvenates that project for sure. There are other projects that I have that I think are so ambitious, you have to be retired, or I don't know, you've just won the lottery and you don't have the commercial pressures of actually having to earn money.
Right. Yeah.
You know, there's a couple of those, which I'd love to, you know, embark on. But, you know, unless there's some ridiculous opportunity that financially allows me to do that.
They're just going to stick in the ideas bank.
Yeah, they stick in the ideas bank, you know. I've got a whiteboard in the office and, you know, it's amazing just putting the notes on the whiteboard.
Mm.
And I do loads of things like just on the phone all the time. I've got this note and I'll just, someone might say something on the radio, or I might see, it could be The Economist and they've got a quote from someone. So I would quite literally just photograph it, circle it in notes and stick it in there, you know, and it becomes like a scrapbook of ideas, and sometimes they cross-pollinate quite nicely. Yeah, that's certainly part of the process. Yeah. But to actually shoot it, no, shooting it, that's, you've got to really get focused on that, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I suppose you've hinted at it there, in that, you know, different projects will start to inform each other as the, you know, as the ideas develop and get bigger, and you know, you come across different things. But what do you see as the, I suppose, the underlying link between, you know, what you're drawn to go and capture as a story? You know, is there any link that you see, you know, any sort of human link or thematic kind of thread that you keep? I suppose a thread that does tie them together.
I think, I'm going to just say something very simple: curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be the theme for me. Stuff I'm interested in learning more about.
Yeah.
I want to learn more about it, and I want to do it first person with my own eyes and ears. You know, and if it sees the light of day, great. If it doesn't, then I've had that moment. I mean, it's an interesting thing, because I don't know whether that lends to a subconscious link. I had a commercial work which I shot as though it was a personal project, actually, that lasted 9 weeks, split into three trips that went across last year. And that was on the border with Russia and Norway, up on the Barents Sea. And, you know, it hadn't even occurred to me. There I was in winter on that border, you know, and I was there with Norwegian military on the Russian border.
Mm-hmm.
And there I was in Pima County a few months later. I hadn't even put that correlation at all. And it was funny, because I was back in Arizona and I was showing a couple of shots. I was like, oh, you're not going to believe it. I was on the border and I did this big selfie with some of the military lot. This is hilarious. Isn't this funny? It was just on the iPhone on your showreel. And I was like, I hadn't even put that to, I just hadn't even put them together. I was just kind of like different headspace.
Hmm.
I mean, that is naivety, I think, but curiosity's led me to both places, but maybe subconsciously those two, you know, very interesting borders of the world are linked, you know?
Yeah. Well, and also, as you said with the Alphabet Soup project, you know, it wasn't black or white, it was gray. And, you know, maybe is that what you're drawn to, you know, trying to find what that gray is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, I mean, if you look at it from the standpoint, I mean, you've got essayists and economists and political thinkers and theologians and everything looking at that border. And I think they're in the same, you know, kind of endless cycle of like, this is really complicated.
Yeah. Different questions being asked.
Yeah. I mean, geopolitics, there's so many examples now, whether it's Bolsonaro down in Brazil or, you know, Trump, you know, these populist approaches of offering, you know, really simplistic answers to very complex questions.
Mm.
I think the tide is turning a little bit. I hope it is, you know, because it's not necessarily just straight right and wrong. You know, the irony on the border wall, in fact, is a lot of those new contracts are coming out and actually labor is being supplied by labor that is owned by the cartels. I mean, the irony just takes on another meaning. I mean,
that's crazy.
You know, but at the end of the day, there's huge financial reward on those contracts. And then it was put to me, you know, with the latest installment of some of that border wall infrastructure, as opposed to surveillance, but actual physical structure on the border, you know, from the sheriff's department, they're like, oh, that's just even more of a headache.
Mm.
Because as far as they see it, there's going to be a load of labor comes in to build the thing. And then they're going to heighten the criminal activity because they want prostitutes. They want contraband themselves. And then you've got a porta cabin out in the desert with a load of people bored. You know, then they're, you know, doing all sorts. And then that becomes an extra complication to it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's another layer that goes on in there, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that grey area is certainly, it's very bright down there, but it's very grey. Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned there the work that you've done up in Norway, and you know, for that particular project, which well, I suppose just touching on that a little more, you know, kind of what was the commercial project that you were working on there that you decided to approach as a personal project, you know, being privy to working with the Norwegian or Russian military, you know, what, how did that come about?
It was again, actually, the seed of that goes back a number of years to funny enough, there's a theme here, I think, Al, is where there was a project I looked at, which was centered around a particular festival in Norway called the Ice Music Festival.
Okay.
And I went out there and I came away with a really interesting story. That's another story. That's for another podcast. Mm-hmm. So I came away with that, and actually I went back the following year and more, and actually became really involved to the point now where I co-produce that particular festival.
Right.
And that's whatever it is, 11, 12 years now. But at the beginning, actually, there was a couple of individuals that I got on really, really well with. One of them was the co-founder, Paul. And the more and more time that I started spending back there, he's very entrepreneurial. And he was like, listen, he said, I've got some interesting work. Could you come and photograph this? So then I'd turn up in the summer, then I'd turn up in the autumn. And it was outside of that winter area of the festival. So I started to know a few more of the people within the community. And each time I went back, just to instruct commercial work, I was finding that there was a common link, that unspoken currency in Norway is quite literally kind of, because it's a small population, large area, but very small population, kind of people know everyone. They really do know someone who knows someone. And that underlying currency of favors goes a long, long way in Norway. It's not obvious at first, but when you're there for a little bit more. And increasingly, there I was, my own phone. If I needed something, I'd be able to phone that Norwegian and that Norwegian would supply it. And within an hour, I'd have a chainsaw or whatever it was I was going to have. Okay. So this is quite interesting. And Paul was over in London one summer, and we started to talk around. I said, listen, your community, where you were born and where you're brought up, there's a lot going on there. They have to have, you know, skills that are getting through the winter. So it might be that they're managing snow clearing in the winter, but then in construction in the summer. You know, but I said, there's some really resourceful people, and this isn't an area that's dying. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's the opposite of what's going on here in the UK, where someone's building a second home or buying a second home, pricing out all the locals. It wasn't happening there. And he said, absolutely. I said, can I do something with this? I'd love to make a little bit of a project. Can I kind of like make a portrait of your community? We sort of did the Spinal Tap approach. You know, a napkin on the table, It was, you know, a few bottles of wine in, but we did it. And I said, you know, the only catch, this isn't cheap. You know, I can't just do this. And he said, no, I think there's a way we can do this. So actually he said, how much do you need? I gave him rough figures on what I envisaged at the time. We came to an agreement, and actually we shot it over 1 year. We combined it in with commercial work as well. Mm. And it ended up becoming Generation YOLO, Portrait of a Community, and that built in itself, that's 52 portraits of key people in this community that really like the socioeconomic fabric of that community. And out of that, because it's Norway, it gets a lot of attention. People start to acknowledge you, and you know, there was government ministers, went to Oslo, got produced into a really beautiful book. So the name got out a little bit within that Norwegian thing that is Norway. And you know, word of mouth, that network kicks in. I ended up meeting other people, starting to work on different projects, commercial projects, started to move around the country a lot more from the south, further north. And at this point, you know, again, I got recommended. Actually, it was, you know, an email that came through, and it was like, look, we're really interested in what you did in YOLO. We want to redevelop the marketing focus around this particular part of Finnmark, in East Finnmark, an area called Varanger.
Right.
And they wanted to mix it up with videography, dronography. Is that a word? Dronography?
It is now.
It is now. And stills. So I looked at it, I thought, this is really nice, but I'd like to take the same approach. So again, it's that client interpreting the brief, client expectations, managing expectations. And the more and more we spoke about it, actually they said, no, you have to do it like that, i.e. how you shot it. Now, I'm still sensitive to that client's needs, because it's still got to be put into the framework of what is ultimately a marketing exercise. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they said, no, we really want to keep it as close to that vision. I said, okay, but I need the time. You know, we need different seasons for this area. So we ended up shooting summer, winter and autumn. And again, that you realize that, in fact, it's not just this is an amazing waterfall or this is a particularly beautiful spot with a beach and everything. you know, it's the people that make that really quite remote area of Norway actually tick. Mm. And there's some really, really interesting people up there. And again, you know, not over-researching an area, but having the time. That's the most valuable part. These opportunities start to come around. So actually, by the third visit, you know, it's 3 week chunks at a time, covering enormous mileage. But that third visit was ridiculous. I mean, the request list of, well, can you come over here and can you come down this valley? And, you know, and that's where you end up, you know, in watchtowers on the border and then going out with patrol. Because actually, it's an employer up there. There is an infrastructure related to that border and the proximity of Russia. Then you start to look at the different administrative angles that come out of that area. So I ended up photographing various mayors. Now, mayors are a bit like our super mayors here. They have executive power in Norway. Right. They're very vital to the community. They have fiscal authority as well. Mm-hmm. And then you start discussing this and you realize that in these conversations, I was with the mayor of Sheikhaness. And Sheikhaness is right on the border. And you've got Murmansk is, you know, a couple of hours in the car. I mean, really, really close. And he's saying, you know, I'm always having conversations. They have this cross-border agreement, which is 50 kilometers either side. So the Russians can come over with, as long as you live and reside in that 100 kilometer zone, you can just go back and forth. You have special permit. And he said, I said, any issues? He said, no. He said, 10% of Varanga is Russian speaking. And he said, at the end of the day, he said, the geopolitics doesn't affect us up here. He says, that's Washington and Moscow and Oslo and London. But he said, actually, in terms of our cross-border environment, this is actually really vibrant. It's as good as it can be for two, what is pitched as adversaries by the media. But he said, actually here, and it's true. And I can speak over three different seasons, which is very, very different up there in terms of what it's offering and access and the tonality. Really, really, it seemed relatively straightforward.
So well, I guess they're so isolated away from any of that. You know, yeah, those bigger city structures or bigger state structures. You know, if you're, I guess it's totally isolated away from that.
It is, but at the same time, and actually, that crept in on Baffin Island because there's huge commercial interest. You know, with climate change as it is, and believe you me, when you're in the Arctic, and it doesn't matter where you are in the Arctic. I mean, it is. You do not have to have any science qualification. You can see it. I mean, you can really, really see it. It's very evident. Everything's accelerated up there. And in fact, actually, the summer, when we were there for the summer part, which was the first part, you know, it went over 30 Celsius whilst we were there. You know, it was nearly 3 weeks of blue sky. And it's like, oh, come on, you know. And you're hearing all the time, you know, 86-year-olds saying, in my living memory, I've only lived here. I've never seen this before. And then you're going into winters that, you know, yes, of course, it still gets cold. You know, you're in Pasvikdalen, it's minus 40, minus 43 air temperature. That's the temperature. But at the same time, they have a whole chunk of winter where it's just sitting around the minus 11. And that is not normal up there. And with that climate change, and you have the wider geographical area, you've got the Barents Sea going around to the White Sea and up into the Arctic Ocean. Well, it's all part of that Arctic Ocean. That is nearly a free-for-all. So, of course, there is a geopolitical pressures that go on there. So, in fact, actually on that border, the amount of infrastructure is quite relevant. I mean, you really feel it when you're up there. You feel that you're very much on the border when you're there. And I think that the locals just accept it and embrace it and know how to work with it.
Okay.
But I only see that increasing because geopolitically, Northwest Passage is open for everyone that can make that financially viable. So then you look at it from, say, for example, Sheikhaness, you know, you've got a port that is largely ice free, you know, so all of a sudden it's got all the infrastructure to take in huge cargo, you know, so they've got a massive iron ore operation up there. Sorvaranga is famous for it. And again, it's an extraordinary large iron ore, open cast iron ore facility, which I had the pleasure of going in. And it was really interesting because that's not been financially viable for a couple of decades, but now it is. And actually it's opening next year. You know, they are reopening and this thing looks like it's in Mordorf or something. I mean, it's just, it really is extraordinary. And all of a sudden the iron ore that's coming out of that particular area of Norway is some of the finest quality on the planet. So the cheap iron ore that is very available is too cheap. So they can't do it, but because the price and availability of this really rarer, higher quality ore, all of a sudden that becomes it's viable to do that. It's not needing any state intervention. You know, you've got a group of investors that have put it together, and they've got the infrastructure. It needs some repair, it needs rejuvenation, but they're ready to go with it. So actually, with climate change, for some people up there, there's a lot of opportunity. It could be political point scoring, but also commercial activity is only going to increase. You know, and that's interesting to observe on the ground, as opposed to a report in the newspaper or reading something online. Actually, just seeing it as like first person is really, really interesting, and to see the different seasons that start to shape that narrative.
Yeah.
I feel privileged to have that as well. You know, that's really, don't take it lightly. It's a really interesting perspective, and I think that starts to filter into, or at least from my perspective, I think that starts to filter into the look and the feel of my work as well.
Yeah. Well, you properly get into the thick of it. I think it's clear to it's clear to say.
Yeah. Without bringing Malcolm Tucker into it, mind you.
yeah. So, taking it all the way back to the beginning, you know, what first got you interested in photography, and I suppose. Yeah. What first sparked that interest?
I think I'm going to speak for probably quite a few photographers here, but you know, as a kid, you know, my father, he did photography he's actually a designer at the time, was specialized in furniture design.
Okay.
And some of the marketing that needed to be done for this furniture, it needed to be photographed.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, there's, you know, there was a medium format camera lying around, and you know, as I was growing up as a child and with my two brothers, he would photograph us. And I think that's where the bug came from. You know, I think I was 11. I got a little Fuji SLR camera, just a film camera with a 50mm standard lens. And I have no idea why to this day, really, because my father just said, by the way, shoot transparency. Don't bother with black and white. He goes, you can cheat like that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay. But I think what it was, I think he saw that I had an eye for composition and subject, but you know, you've got to learn the relationship in terms of controlling the light.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously with transparency, you've got to get it pretty good. So, you know, before long, that 35mm film will come back and all of them were well exposed, or should I say correctly exposed.
Yeah.
You know, and I go through my teenage years, always I was the one with the camera, you know, because obviously back then there wasn't all these phones around, and, you know, and I was the person with that camera, and I'd be, it doesn't matter whether at parties or on holiday, those ski trips to America, you know, the documentation's from the fact that I had the camera there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that moves through, and you know, as you're growing older, you realize that you're in work and you're putting all your paid holiday, which I referred to before, into doing these shoots, you know. And I'd shoot them as though I was on a National Geographic assignment, which is hilarious. Mm-hmm. Really, you know, but that was my way of escaping and just discovering the world, and that curiosity.
Okay.
You know, and it came to a point where over the years, various people and girlfriends would say, oh, you should become a photographer. And of course, my heart was very much there, but my business head was not. And then, you know, you think, well, you've got to strike out sometimes. You just got to do it. And I did, and I don't regret any second of it. And
so what were you doing before taking on photography full time?
I was in retail.
Okay.
In the ski and outdoor industry. Yeah, completely different. Yeah, it was great. No problem at all. You know, I did university as well. Did some landscape architecture. I didn't like uni particularly. I didn't finish the course because I was like, I really can't see myself doing this, you know, and I had all sorts of different jobs. And then you end up landing, and actually really in my 20s was a well-paid job, you know, good security. And I actually enjoyed it. And there was loads of, you know, interesting components to that job. But you know, ultimately, it's still the photography just beckoned.
That was where your heart was. Yeah.
And that jump, because I never went to, you know, a school of photography, or, you know, I didn't have that receptive network that you would have coming out of one of the good colleges of photography. So what I did have is some business acumen. So I thought, well, I wonder if I can just pitch it that way. So I did, you know, for a couple of years, I made sure I put myself in a financial position where I could just give it a go, so I wasn't having to get all those secondary jobs to compensate. You know, I had a few months where you come out that metaphorical 9-to-5 run, and you kind of, it's very, very freeing actually. And then you start to concentrate on what you like photographing, you know, and then you start building it. And obviously opportunities arise, you run with them, you get a couple of lucky breaks, you embrace them, you know, and you start building that portfolio, you start building that body of work, and you start building that reliability with clients.
Mm-hmm.
Does your face fit? are you, oh, he's still here 3 years on, he's still turning up at this event or whatever it's going to be, you know. And you get regular clients then, and all of a sudden, you know, fiscally, you've got a business model that's running throughout the year, you know. So, you know, and then obviously you start investing in equipment, and you're starting to look at avenues of how you can start to, you know, financially make your vision work. You know, I'm not aspiring to, you know, drive a Ferrari, so that absolute pressure of photographing everything isn't there, you know. Yeah. But at the same time, I wanted to ensure that that curiosity and that the vision that I have, you know, isn't diluted too much. I mean, I'm not trying to be precious, but I think I don't want to compromise too much. I mean, you know, I think you put yourself in a position where you can court the right client base, you know, and ensure that you're satisfying their needs, expanding that, looking for new opportunities where appropriate, and also being honest with what you can offer as well. You know, at the same time, within the personal work, that's a way of also, you can experiment with things, you have that space to try new things, and then, you know, that can tie back in from the business perspective. And then you have these sort of sweet spots, the work in Varanga, where they said, no, we don't want anything more than what you're doing, like as though you were coming up here, landing and walking around with a camera. I mean, you know, I mean, that really is, that's like absolute perfect mix.
A peach, yeah. So after you had made that transition, you know, from just shooting for, you know, out of an interest to working commercially, did you dive straight into the investigative side? You know, was that always your approach, or was it a case where, oh, you know, I need to do some corporate headshots to get started? You know, what did that transition look like?
That's interesting, because it happens. It's not overnight. That corporate headshot, that's there for sure. I'm not going to deny a corporate headshot, of course. I'm not going to deny doing, you know, hotel interiors. It has its place, and certainly at points in your career, it also pays the bills, as long as you're doing it, you know, in a really thoughtful, considered way. Well, why not? At the same time, it's not necessarily how you know, I think that I still wanted to ensure that I had my own vision that we've been referring to packaged into it. And sometimes, again, it comes into the case of, actually, I'm not so sure about that, because A, the subject matter, I'm just not particularly interested in. I think that's important. You know, big advice I was having, for example, you know, in those webinars was like, if you're interested in a subject, straight off, that's an advantage, because you care about that subject. And I think that as much as you can professionally produce something that works, it might not have that extra something where you're actually interested in it. So, you know, that transition, it builds up. I think that you have to have that reliability, the consistency, ensuring that that same client is calling you, and they might have, you know, something that's happening 3, 4, 5 times a year. You need to make sure you're front of the queue. You're the photographer that's turning up. There might be a videographer as well, but you're the photographer that's turning up for that. Because at that point, you know, you're having, you know, again, photographers, they'll know that the interface you either have that client might well be an individual or a team. Those teams change, you know, and if you're being around for a few years, you've got to ensure that you're relevant to that new team. Or, I don't know, you might have a go-to person, and that go-to person changes. The new one might have their own Emil with them, you know. So, you know, that, and I think that transition, it's gradual. It's not just overnight. You know, I think that within reason, you make your own luck, and I think you should seize it and just reinforce it. I mean, there's a common thread, actually, was that one of my early jobs that I was doing was shaping the visual narrative for a really, really interesting initiative, which was in UK secondary schools, called Musical Futures. And that was started actually as a pilot project in the mid-noughties, and that was coming in at, I think it was 4 schools, and they were looking at new methods of teaching music in secondary school. And that was actually the initial seed money for that pilot project came from a grant from the Paul Hamlin Foundation, and they're one of the largest providers of grants in arts, education and social justice in the UK, in fact, if not Europe. Enormous grant provider. And, you know, I was not aware of Paul Hamlin Foundation at that point, but I got more and more involved with Musical Futures, traveling the length and breadth of the UK, and going in and really starting to piece together how that's presented. And obviously the birth of online really coming into its own. They had, you know, apps that are available cross-platform. Paul Hamlin ended up putting a lot of money and many millions into it. And actually it went into over 1,500 schools across the UK. Mm. And out of that, then you realize actually other people that are connected to Paul Hamlin Foundation or within it. So actually we've got this other project that we've been working on. And then that might allow you to display different skill sets. So you're going in from a straight, you know, you've got a 5D and a, you know, and a lens and you're documenting something. But then on the next one, you've got a chance of actually, you know, shaping that narrative and really starting to direct it and build it. And then you, you know, that you get a reputation for being able to do that too. So again, you know, I think a lot of, again, I'm sure other photographers have this. It's like that music family tree, you know, so-and-so's connected to so-and-so and so-and-so, you know. I mean, actually, you know, I did 2 months worth of work in central China. And it, I won't bore this podcast, but actually, if you look at it, the dots are all joined back. It's extraordinary. Mm. But that's over, you know, in that particular case, that was over a 3-year period for those dots to all join. And there you are. You end up in a, you know, remote part of South Central China working on really, really interesting work. So again, it's sort of building that structure of business and making sure that you can afford the business and actually make a living from it, while satisfying your own personal development, you know, that's not overnight. That takes a lot of work. You know, and it's an enjoyable thing, but you'd be surprised how small some of these worlds are. I think. And, you know, again, yeah, I'm very, very happy in how it's turning out. That's for sure.
But again, that seems to point back to, you know, being in the thick of it and being available and being interested.
For sure. Yeah, being interested. I mean, I'm not trying to sell it. I really care about what I photograph. And I really care about, actually, funny enough, I much prefer, and it was from the very beginning, you know, I'm interested in long-term relationships. If it's from a client perspective, long-term relationships, you know, because actually the more and more, they'll understand the more and more how you work and vice versa, you know, and if they've got a good creative team or an agency attached to that as well, that's even better because it's like a nearly holistic approach to doing it, and you can see the results. You know, that often there's so much better. I mean, I've done quite a lot of work with a few of the nation's foremost providers of support to adult learning difficulties and autism, and it's really, really interesting, really noteworthy work that they do. And but it's not, dare I say, glamorous. It's not celebrity driven. It's not kind of going to sit in a photography exhibition. But why should that particular organization have inferior visual narrative?
Right. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Actually, because really what they're doing is extremely important, morally right, you know. So I would much rather come in and say, look, how can we do this? Can we get everything arranged where I can come in and really put my eye on that? And it's not just one of the care workers with an iPhone, as much as that's valid, you know, because when you start learning more about how their funding structures work, actually, a lot of it's crucial on having that good evidence-led visual narrative. Now, that might not be for public consumption. Well, that's fine, because actually internally within their world, I want it to be as good as it possibly can. So again, I don't look down on that. In fact, I embrace that. And that's worked really, really well. I mean, it's just been very, very interesting, because out of that, again, like that network, people leave and cross over, and then they'll turn up in a different sector, but similar interests, you know. And there you are. I mean, The Hidden City, that was actually from another freelancer that's worked with the producers of the London Jazz Festival.
Okay.
And again, you know, that was
just one thing led to another.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so, and again, it works. It works really nicely. Yeah.
So, and I suppose, again, going back to the, you know, I've got a picture of you in my mind, you know, going through these desolate landscapes of Arizona or Scandinavia. Like, if you're kind of going out there as I suppose, for want of a better word, a lone wolf, you know, what kit are you traveling with? You know, how do you, I suppose, stay quick on your feet but not be without kit that you need to, you know, make a shot when you find one?
That depends on what the objective is. Commercially, I do want to travel with lighting. So above and beyond the camera equipment, there's lighting in there as well. I'm really good, one man band. I've got an adaptive snowball bag that takes all the lighting stands, modifiers and everything in there. Mm-hmm. I've got another roller that will take a couple of Profoto B1s, you know, and then, you know, on the back, you've got, you know, the various camera equipment. And actually, you know, from a commercial perspective, it's incredible how much you can shoot with mix. Yeah. I mean, it's extraordinary, you know. Personal project stuff, you know, if you're going out into Arizona, in that particular one, I took a very conscious decision of no lighting. So I didn't even take it with me. So there wasn't a temptation to start to augment the scene in any way, you know. Also, I took that decision on not shooting people. So that was conscious. So that becomes much lighter. I think I shot myself in the foot, really, because I was like, yeah, I'm just going to throw every single format at it. So that probably just built it up. But one thing I am quite passionate about is actually not a huge host of lenses. So I tend to be, I love a standard lens. Doesn't matter what the recording format is. I love a standard lens, a good standard lens. You know, and I'll shoot whole projects. Welcome to the quiet zone. Every single frame is just 180 mil.
Okay.
That's it. You know, and I love the purity of that. You know, and then I will draw in depending. I mean, obviously, I've got a suite of equipment, and then I scale it up and down depending on the job requirements. And that is also in terms of whether I need assistance coming into that job as well. So I can scale up and down. But I think I did so many years of being that kind of one man band. You become very efficient at having that blend of equipment. You know, throwing it in the back of the car and going. You know, it's a good one, but. Yeah, I wish some of it was a bit lighter sometimes. But, you know, aside from that, you know.
Yeah, but you like the challenge, obviously.
Yeah, it's exactly that. Yeah. It's funny actually because there's this endless debate on. I mean, I don't particularly care for whether it's digital or film, because actually I think that, you know, again, this is a little bit of an easy comment, but, you know, just because, for example, with film, it's shot on Portra 400, therefore it's a good shot. Well, no, not necessarily, you know, because the film doesn't dictate the creative ability of that.
Sure,
person.
Sure. Yeah. And say it's same the other way around as well. You know, if it's super high resolution digital, then that doesn't mean it's going to be a better piece of work.
Absolutely. So I think that you suit it for the work that you're doing. Obviously, you know, there's particular workflows you're using as well will dictate, especially in that commercial sense, for sure. But at the same time, you know, I'm always interested in, take that film thing. What's happening? Is there a mix of additional lighting within that film shot as opposed to just relying on the decision of Kodak to have that particular hue or color tones, you know? Because I think that's another thing. There seems to be this purity angle to both arguments. Both are subjective.
Yeah.
You know, and back in the film day, you were asking for Fuji. You know, you wanted it really punchy. You would shoot on Velvia. Mm-hmm. You know, well, that's no different to turning up that dreaded clarity button.
Right.
You know, so you know, both sides are subjective. I don't think there's any right and wrong, and I think that the creative process in terms of capturing that is way more important and more valid to the final result than the recording medium, for sure.
Yeah, cool. And I suppose just to round off, you know, what outside of photography, you know, what inspires you, and you know, kind of what where do you draw inspiration from, non-photographically?
Film, yeah, very visual. I love film. Politics, that's really, really. I'm highly political, although I don't necessarily publicly put it out. Anyone that knows me closely will be aware of that, but politics for sure, geopolitics. Music, I've always been absolutely, I love it. I can't play anything at all.
What sort of thing?
Oh God, can I just say eclectic?
Eclectic,
get out, isn't it?
Yeah.
Eclectic, yeah. But it really is. It's you know, I'm really interested in a lot of music. That's really good. You know, and just, yeah, I suppose living and, you know, get out on the bike, thrash around the woods and things like that. It's great. But a lot of it centers around, you know, my mind is definitely image led. That's for sure. And outside of that, I think what influences it is, yeah, sort of like that political junkie in a way, for sure. That's never left me since I was really politically aware as a teenager. That's not gone. So actually a lot of what I read still feathers into that. And I think that just forms, you know, opinions. And then I suppose what's interesting is it was pointed out to me only recently, someone who knows me quite well saying, man, you're so political, but you don't display that within any of your work. An alphabet soup, that's really been playing on my mind. That's
I guess there's a temptation really there to be quite political.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't want that actually with it. And it's not the obvious thing, you know, it's and again, there's no right and wrong to that. But again, it's a situation I'm sort of caught in that because, yeah, again, that will be one of my biggest interests, I think, consumptive interests. Yeah, my family's like, oh, my God, he's going on about that again.
you keep your eyes and your ears open.
You got it. Nicely put. I like that. Yeah, and to question.
Yeah, cool.
I think that's very, very healthy. Just to question, have a little, you know, make sure the resources are trusted and really start digging around. You know, in this day and age, it's very, very easy to sink down some really siloed rabbit holes.
You
need to be able to pull out of that and actually oversee it a little bit more, because it's not grey. Not black and white. A lot of it is grey, you know.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. Well, thanks for taking the time to do this, man.
No, real privilege. Thank you for including me in the series. It's been brilliant. I've really enjoyed this, and good luck with the series.